We're going to talk about saturation and reversals in numerical dynamos, and some of the other talks following the one I'm going to give deal with some specifics of magnetic polarity reversals. And I'd like to dwell on three topics. The first one actually was treated in large part by Uli Christensen this morning, so I'll be able to run through this material quickly. I first want to discuss saturation of magnetic field intensity in rotating spherical dynamos as particularly it pertains to the dipole component of the field. In many planetary situations, of course, all we have to observe is the external field, and in some cases, really only just the lowest order moments of that external field, the dipole, and perhaps a few other components. So what we'd like to do, of course, is be able to establish some theoretical or numerically based relationship between the part of the field that we can readily observe from the outside and what's going on inside the dynamo itself. And then I want to turn to something beyond just the time average properties of dynamos and talk about their variation in time. And I'm going to preface this discussion with a little review of the low-frequency geomagnetic secular variation and what we think we know about that now. And then I want to talk about low-frequency variability and the connection with polarity reversals in dynamo models. So that's the plan. And this is a slide for motivation. This is a map of the pattern of the geomagnetic field on the core mantle boundary. The continents, which are always drawn on these maps, are, of course, there for reference only. There aren't continents, or at least there aren't continents like this on the core mantle boundary. What this shows is the radial intensity of the field that crosses through the core mantle boundary, expressed in millitesla. And this is for the EPIC 2006, the PALM-4 model evaluated in the year 2006. So it's about as current a map as we have available for us. And the crosses and the circles represent the dipole axis. Well, a few comments about this map. First of all, it's truncated at a certain spherical harmonic degree because we have a difficult time seeing through the Earth's crust, and so we can only see the longest wavelength features in the field. And this particular map is truncated around L equals 13. The dipole moment, as we speak right now, the geomagnetic dipole moment, is 77 and some zeta amp meter squared. It's decreasing, as you all know, rather rapidly. The current rate of decrease is about minus 0.05 in the same units per year. And that is, as we calculate it, taking a nominal value for the electrical conductivity of the core, that's of the order of 10 times the free decay rate of the dipole field. You can see that there's a lot of structure in the geomagnetic field on the core mantle boundary. Nonetheless, it is dipole dominated. The dipolarity at present time is of the order of 0.6 on this surface. Well, this image is here for motivation. It raises really fundamental questions that dynamo theory and dynamo models can address. And if I started with the most basic questions that images like this raise, I would ask, what does dynamo theory have to say about explaining the structure? Why does the Earth's magnetic field have the intensity that it has? And why does it change? And change at the rates that we observe. So those are indeed really basic questions. And we can address some of those, as we heard this morning, by examining systematic patterns in numerical dynamo models. So I want to talk now about some of the saturation patterns as we currently understand them, obtained by synthesizing the results from a large number of numerical dynamos, covering a parameter range represented by this plot here. This is the Rayleigh number. These are all convective dynamos. And here's the inverse Ekman number. And this is a study that I was involved with Uli Christensen a couple of years ago. And we got through the literature and through our own endeavors about 150 numerical dynamos that had been run long enough so that we could take meaningful time averages of their results. And we are primarily interested in the time average strength of the dipole field, the field strength on the outer boundary, the RMS internal field strength, and the RMS value of the kinetic energy or fluid velocity. So here's the range of parameters we were able to study in Rayleigh number, Ekman number space. This little insert diagram shows the range of Prandtl numbers in this study. So this is a fairly wide range, but I just, of course, need to remind everybody that the Earth is nowhere near this range. Here's a list of nominal parameter values for the geodynamo. And so if we were able to plot the dynamo on this diagram, it would be up somewhere about where that light that's turned on is in terms of its position on this diagram, and somewhere about floor level on this diagram here. So obviously, successful extrapolation is the name of the game in using these models for this kind of purpose. Okay. One of the most commonly used assumptions, similarity assumptions, in applying dynamo theory, dynamo models to the planets, is the so-called constant Elsasser number assumption. It was discussed by Dave Stevenson and Willie Christensen earlier today. It's a very attractive similarity assumption because it says that the magnetic field equilibrates in a planetary dynamo at a strength which is independent of the energy source, or at least doesn't depend explicitly on the energy source. So here's the definition of the Elsasser number that we'll be using here. And you can easily test in the context of these models whether or not it's a good assumption, a weak assumption, or poor assumption by plotting this parameter against some other parameter of the models. And so here I'm plotting it against the Rayleigh number that Willie Christensen defined this morning, which is based on the buoyancy flux. Again, these are all convective dynamos. And this is a data set that includes a lot of different boundary conditions and modes of thermal forcing, internal heat generation, as well as dynamos that are driven by basal heating. And what you can see, of course, is there's a very large scatter in this data. So the first conclusion is that the constant Elsasser number assumption is not borne out by these models. Again, unless you're willing to accept quite a range in the value of that parameter. Whether or not there are any systematics in terms of the Elsasser number, of course, can't be seen readily from this diagram, but there's a suggestion that there is kind of a rough systematic here, although some additional member of the family of dimensionless parameters should be introduced into this relationship to make it collapse. Yes. Yeah. I failed to mention up here in the title. Yes, yeah, so this is the Elsasser number for the RMS dipole field strength. So it's a fraction of the total field strength. And that's why they're shifted down. Yeah, thanks for bringing that to my attention. Okay, so can we do better? Well, the obvious thing to add to this kind of analysis is to introduce the energy source. And so Christensen and colleagues have come up with a set of parameters which depend directly on the available energy for the dynamo expressed in terms of the buoyancy flux. So here's this Rayleigh number based on the buoyancy flux. And what we've done here is we've scaled the RMS convective velocity, or actually the RMS velocity in the dynamo model, and the dipole field strength on the outer boundary in terms of this parameter. The two dimensionless parameters that we use for this comparison are the Rossby number, defined here in terms of the RMS velocity, and then this Lorentz number. Again, it will be used for the dipole field, but it has this general definition in terms of the previously used dimensionless parameter. The Lorentz number is the square root of the product of the Elsasser number, the magnetic Prandtl number, and the Ekman number. Okay, well, what do you get when you scale things this way? First of all, you get pretty good results in terms of the velocities. As pointed out this morning, despite the fact that these are dynamos with widely different magnetic field strengths, they seem to yield a systematic relationship for the convective velocity, which is independent of what actually that field strength is. And you can see that it's possible to fit these models over a wide range of this parameter with a scaling law with an exponent of about 2/5. This study has one more additional feature that was not discussed this morning, in that we added some dynamo models that were driven by internal heat generation, in addition to the ones represented by crosses, which are driven by basal heating. And they follow the same exponent, but they have a different coefficient. They produce slightly weaker, slightly smaller convective velocities for the Rayleigh number defined the same way. And it's, I think, to the credit of the scaling law that a different kind of forcing produces the same trend, but with only a different coefficient. situation is a little bit different with regard to the scaling of the dipole field. And here things are more complicated. First of all, if we were to put the dynamos driven by internal heat generation on this diagram for the dipole field, they would not follow this law particularly well. You can see that I've only considered dynamo models driven by basal heating in terms of in the lower figure here. Furthermore, I've restricted the cases to those in which the Nusselt number is reasonably large, roughly 2 or larger, so they're rather fully convective. And I've restricted it to cases which are dipole dominant, in which they had a dipolarity in excess of about 0.5 or 0.6. So it's a limited data set compared to the one used for this. And even so, it shows more scatter. And perhaps more importantly than that, it's not really an asymptotic law. This might be an asymptotic law. We don't know. We haven't gone far enough to, I guess, really say. But we're already sure this is not one, because dynamo models which pass beyond this limit right here begin to deviate substantially. In many cases, there's this transition from dipole state to non-dipolar state, which can be very abrupt. But in any case, there is a systematic deviation beyond this point here. That's too bad in a way, because we saw, of course, that when we put in dimensionless values, we find out that the Earth should scale somewhere near this transition. And I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Okay, well, how does the geodynamo fit on this diagram? Well, let's see whether or not we can obtain sensible results by assuming this particular power law scaling law and apply it to the geomagnetic dipole moment. Remember that it has the form of the Lorentz number varies as the Rayleigh number to the 1/3 power with a coefficient which is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2. If we unwrap this formula and put it into dimensional units, it says that the equivalent dipole moment varies as the buoyancy flux times the shell thickness to the 1/3 power with a coefficient which depends in physical terms only on the density. Okay? If we invert this expression and solve for the expected convective buoyancy flux and insert the present-day geomagnetic dipole moment, we get a buoyancy flux of about 2 times 10 to the minus 13 meters squared per second cubed. If we convert that to the equivalent convective heat flow at the just below the core mantle boundary, that's something in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 terawatts. So it's a ballpark correct figure. In other words, what we're saying is if the geodynamo obeys this kind of scaling, we can produce the observed present-day geomagnetic dipole moment with a convective heat flow, which is of the order of a few terawatts. Okay. Well, it's interesting to see how this goes back in time. This relationship is true. We have a proportionality between the activity of the dynamo expressed in terms of its primary energy source and the strength of the dipole moment that it produces. It might be possible, for example, to use this to unravel something about the Earth's thermal evolution by tracking the variation in the geomagnetic dipole back into the deep past. So I put together this table here, which shows our estimates for the strength of the geomagnetic dipole expressed in units of 10 to the 22 amp meters squared over different intervals of geologic time and actually recent time. I would make the statement on the basis of this table that here in the 21st century, we do not know what the time average geomagnetic dipole is with any reasonable precision. We know it during the historical era, thanks to the work of Andy Jackson and colleagues. We know to 3 significant figures what it is over the last 160 years. Well, maybe not 3 significant figures, but let's say 2. That's adequate. But if we go back in time further, of course, we have to rely on more indirect measures of the dipole moment derived from archaeomagnetism and paleomagnetic techniques. And, of course, the corresponding uncertainty begins to rise. And so if you look back, you look at this table, what you see are variations in the average value of the dipole moment over time intervals measured in fractions of a million of a year up to a few millions of years. And here's the bottom entry here is an average over 300 million years. And let's just focus on this one for the point here. It's 4.6 plus or minus 3.2. Now, I'm not one of the people who make these kind of determinations, but when I talk to them, they insist that not all of this variability is due to measurement error. They insist that some of the plus or minus, the standard deviations here, represents real variability, that the geomagnetic dipole has long-term variations in its intensity. And so it's very difficult to construct a meaningful average over any finite time interval.
Peter,
yes?
Does anybody quote a standard deviation, for instance?
A measurement standard deviation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a measurement error.
If you need something more than the mean to tell the story, does anybody quote anything more than the mean?
That's what they quote, those plus and minuses.
Well, okay.
Yeah. But how much of that is measurement error and how much of that is real variability depends on the study, and that's harder to determine. Well, okay, we have some additional evidence that this kind of variability is genuine from looking at the magnetic history preserved in the seafloor. This is a remarkable record produced by Vallée and colleagues and published in Nature in 2005, which shows something called the virtual geomagnetic dipole moment. In fact, I think it's the virtual axial geomagnetic dipole moment, as a function of time from the present to 2 million years ago. It's derived from the intensity of magnetization of deep sea sediments, which are then converted through a series of steps to the equivalent geomagnetic dipole moment that would be necessary to magnetize those sediments. And then the individual sediment records from around the global ocean are stacked together and calibrated against measurements taken from volcanic rocks at specific intervals along this time trace. The volcanic rocks produce more reliable intensity measurements, and so they are able to be used in part to calibrate this record. And so because it's a stack of marine sediment intensities, it's called SINT. But let's look at its character. Not very well shaded here. But what you're supposed to be able to see, if you can, I don't know if you can from the back there, is the individual normal and reverse polarity epochs. Normal polarity epoch now, reverse epoch and whatnot. And what you see are these large amplitude broadband fluctuations with characteristic time scale of perhaps 50 to 100,000 years. And every so often, the dipole field, if this is the dipole field indeed, reduces down to a level which is about 10 or 20% of its time average value. And all of the major polarity boundaries occur in connection with these events. Now, I call these events dipole collapses, and I would maintain for the purposes of this talk that the key to understanding polarity reversals is to understand what causes these dipole collapse events. Because in this period of time here, you can see that there are perhaps half a dozen or a dozen of these events, most of which end up in reversals, and the deepest of them produce reversals or excursions. By the way, for comparison here, I plotted the free decay time of the dipole field in the core. Here's 10 dipole free decay times for reference. Okay. At the same time, paleomagneticians are beginning to construct estimates of the frequency spectrum of the geomagnetic field over the bandwidth represented by records like the one I just showed you. And this is something that's surprising to me. Here is a compilation of some recent estimates. Here's the frequency spectrum of the SINT record that I just showed you in red. The black line is a composite estimate of the geomagnetic frequency spectrum. By the way, the units here are dipole power as a function of frequency expressed in reciprocal millions of years. This is a composite spectrum constructed by putting together, stitching together, a spectra from the geomagnetic field, from the archaeomagnetic fluctuations, from records like the SINT records, and then a model for how the intensity of the field varies over the course of many, many polarity reversals. And it's useful to divide the spectrum into three parts. This is the portion of the spectrum or the band that represents secular variation. This portion here represents the average duration of a polarity chron. And the very low frequency represents what are called superchrons. And the geomagnetic spectrum is energized in that band because the length or the interval distribution of chrons is very uneven. There are several long periods of time of the order of 40 million years apiece where there are no reversals. Then, of course, there's many chrons that are much shorter than that, fractions of a million years. And so what you get is a spectrum here in which most of the geodynamo variability is in very low frequencies. The part of the spectrum that we commonly model with geodynamo models is here. Okay. But the variance in the geomagnetic field is at much lower frequencies. And this is an argument that if we really want to understand the behavior of the dynamo in the context of dynamo models, it's important that we look at the behavior of those models at very low frequencies. Okay. So what I'll do now is show you some examples of dynamo modeling at very low frequencies. I would like to be able to compute a dynamo model over the entire seafloor record. The entire seafloor record is 160 million years, 200 reversals, one supercron, and although that seems like a dream now, I think perhaps the next time this group gets together at KITP, somebody will get up and present an example of such a calculation. I'm going to show you a calculation that lasts 6 million years, but of course it's just a beginning. There's no real reason why modeling of this sort can't be undertaken in the near future. The equations I'm going to solve are the Navier-Stokes equation, the induction equation, incompressibility, continuity equation, and for buoyancy, I'm going to use a model of the light elements transport that accompanies the growth of the inner core, the so-called chemical convection driving force for the geodynamo, in which the concentration of light elements is represented by this variable chi. Here's the scaling in these equations. It has Elsasser number magnetic field scaling. And the only unusual aspect of this equation is that there's this source term here that appears in the light elements transport equation, which represents the secular change in the composition of light elements in the outer core, which is assumed to be constant over the duration of this model. And that gives rise, it appears then, in the Rayleigh number being proportional to the rate of change of light element concentration in the outer core. So that's the driving force for it. If we're going to do long-term simulations, we have to compromise. And the compromises that I make are to take a small model, which rotates slowly so that a large sparse grid can be used with large time steps. So I'm going to assume an Ekman number defined in that expression up there of 6.5 times 10 to the minus 3, a Prandtl number of 1, and a magnetic Prandtl number of 20, which gets me into a rather high magnetic Reynolds number regime, even though the Rayleigh number is going to be fairly modest. These are, perhaps as some of you know, lead to rather simply structured dynamos with large-scale coherent structures which evolve slowly in time. They have the advantage, therefore, of being somewhat transparent and possibly easier to analyze and understand than dynamo models which are nominally more realistic but are far more complicated. So here's what the fields look like in these models. Here's the perturbation light element concentration in the equatorial plane. Here's the axial component of the field in the equatorial plane, and here's what the field looks like on the outer surface. I've drawn the continents there again for reference, and velocity arrows indicate the circulation in that plane. The magnetic field in the equatorial plane is almost entirely concentrated in the anticyclones. There are two anticyclones that are stable in this model, and in this particular case, the polarity of the field is like the normal polarity of the geomagnetic field. And so these two flux bundles, which are concentrated in the center of these anticyclones, both have negative polarity. Okay? If we compute models like this over a long period of time and take their statistics, we get results like in these lower three panels. This shows, as a function of the Rayleigh number, from below the critical value up to about 6 times 10 to the fourth, again for these parameters up here, the RMS velocity expressed as the magnetic Reynolds number, the RMS total field, and the RMS dipole field on the outer boundary. The dots represent the average values and the bars represent one standard deviation. The dots that are filled are dynamo models that reverse their polarity. And what you can see is that increasing the Rayleigh number is the surest way to make a dynamo model reverse. I think this is generally known. We talked about the scaling properties of the time average properties of dynamo models earlier, and you can see a pretty good power law type trend evident in the mean time average properties of the fluid velocity for these dynamos. But it's a little bit sobering to see that the magnetic field statistics don't seem to follow smooth or uniform power law type variations. For example, the RMS field rises from the dynamo onset up to a kind of a peak value with an Elsasser number of about 16, and then just stays more or less constant. The dipole strength is even more difficult to unravel. There seems to be some bistable behavior just after onset, and then it jumps up to a large value and then decreases with increasing Rayleigh number. But the most important thing about this diagram is the large standard deviation in the statistics of the field and the dipole field on the boundary, where the fluctuations are almost as large as the mean value. With such a large standard deviation, which what it means is these dynamos here spend an appreciable time with very weak dipole fields, which means they're very prone to reversal. And that's basically the statistical explanation for their reversing behavior. Okay, here's some time series from one case. I chose this one because it scales according to Christensen's formula that if we extrapolate it at 15 orders of magnitude, it gives the right dipole moment for the Earth on time average. Okay. Got a Rayleigh number of 1.9 times 10 to the fourth. And here are time series of the fluid velocity, the RMS internal field strength, the dipole field strength on the outer boundary, and the dipole tilt. Those are all the black traces as a function of dipole decay time. So here's the dipole decay time, and here's the scalings I'm using for magnetic field and velocity here. So 300 dipole decay times is about 6 million years in paleomagnetic time. Okay. And what you can see here is, of course, there's a lot of fluctuation, as we would anticipate. The velocity, the model overturns about 10,000 times, something like that, in the course of this computation. The magnetic field varies with a slightly lower frequency content, and the dipole with a correspondingly lower frequency content than that. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4 polarity reversals during this epoch. The length of the polarity chrons are slightly different from one another, and they seem to be dispersing a bit. I terminated this calculation when the polarity bias was zero, so that there was equal amount of time spent in both polarities. You can see the reversals are fairly short on this time. In addition to reversals, there are these events where the tilt, the dipole tilt, makes an excursion towards to large values, and these are perhaps similar to excursion events in the paleomagnetic record. The colored traces are low-pass filtered versions of the velocity and the dipole field, and I've just reproduced them down on this image here to show you that the dipole field and the RMS fluid velocity are almost exactly out of phase at low frequency. The correlation is like minus 0.98 or something. Okay, and so this is not the equilibration mechanism, but it's a consequence of the equilibration. Is there just a trade-off at low frequencies between kinetic and magnetic energy? That's in part because the way I'm forcing this model is with this constant buoyancy sink. So it has constant forcing in time. And that means that the dissipation in the model is more or less constant in time. And so you get this energy trade-off. I want to look in detail at some of these events. And I'm going to pay particular attention to this event number one, which is outlined here in yellow, which included this reversal. And I'll talk a little bit about a companion event, this one right here, number two, which is otherwise similar to this one but didn't produce a reversal. It produced a minor excursion. Okay. Before I do that, here are the frequency spectra from that trace, from that time series. Here's the power spectrum of the RMS velocity, the RMS internal field, the RMS boundary dipole, and the axial component of the boundary dipole, power or variance, as a function of frequency. Here I've made the frequency dimensional. This is per kilo year, assuming a dipole-free decay time of 20,000 years. Okay? And you can see that these spectra are broadly similar to the kind of shape that we saw in the geomagnetic power spectrum, with most of their variance at very low frequencies. These were not run long enough, and they actually don't have quite the right property to show the final energizing at ultra-low frequencies. If they were run longer and if they had very unequal polarity chrons, then the really low frequencies would have another bump in amplitude. But the plateau that we saw at intermediate frequencies in the geomagnetic power spectrum is represented here. And then there's at least a suggestion that there are power law regions. And I've sketched in power laws F to the minus 2, F to the minus 7 thirds here and here to indicate that there are intermediate frequency regions that seem to follow some kind of power law behavior. And there's typically a Ni in these spectra at a value of about 20 in these units that's present in at least 3 out of the 4. And beyond that, they fall off very rapidly. Okay, let me look at, in a little bit more detail at this one particular polarity reversal event. So this is event 1 that was on the previous time series. Here I've just blown up the time series, so here is the record in dipole decay times. It's running from 114 to 119. So it's 5 dipole decay times. This is about 100,000 years of paleomagnetic time. And the top plot shows the velocities. This is the RMS field. This is the strength of the dipole. And here's the tilt. And obviously, this is the transition when the dipole tilt changes from one hemisphere to the other. And I've indicated that by shading. You can see that it lasts about one half of one of these units, about 10,000 years of time. I can see on my screen, but I don't know if you can see on your screen. The area I've shaded here is the dipole collapse region. So A is the collapse phase, when the dipole strength decreases. B is the transition, and C is the recovery. When I first saw these fluctuations, I thought they might be waves. Okay. It turns out that all components of the field are roughly in phase with one another during these fluctuations. You can detect a slight difference in phase between the dipole and the internal field in this record. But for the most part, the fluctuations in the magnetic field components, the primary ones, at low frequencies, are in phase with one another. And I think now, although I don't fully understand the mechanism that causes this phenomenon, I think now, though, that it is certainly not a wave. It's actually a transition where the character of the dynamo changes rather fundamentally during its collapse phase here versus its recovery. And I think you can see that if you look at the amount of high frequency variability in the velocity during this time versus during this recovery time here. During the recovery, the dipole becomes very, very uniform with very little variation and essentially goes into what looks like a pure kinematic growth mode. And it grows in intensity until it reaches some sort of saturation intensity where an instability apparently sets in and excites this kind of variability you see in the kinetic energy. And from that time down to the collapse, the effect of this variability is to draw energy from the dipole. And just to depict that, this shows some streak diagrams where I've taken the radial integral of the axial vorticity and the radial integral of the axial magnetic field in the equatorial plane. Just integrate these images across the radius and plot them as a function of longitude and time during the period of reversal. This is the axial field and this is the axial vorticity. And these streaks here, colored streaks, blue and yellow, represent the motion of these flux ropes, which are drifting around in a longitudinal sense. The slope of these lines represents the drift rate. You can see the transition in the background, in this gradual change in background color from pink to blue in this diagram. The actual time of the reversal is right about here. What's interesting is that this flux bundle here does not actually reverse its polarity at the time of the reversal. It does so gradually over a lengthy period of time. And the reversal in this is rather anticlimactic event. It simply corresponds to the time when the strength of these two flux bundles are equal enough so that they cancel out the axial dipole. Prior to that, the red one is stronger, and after it, the blue one is stronger. What causes that is perhaps this idea that the flow is more variable during the time of the dipole collapse. And perhaps you can get some indication of that variability if you look at the coherency of the streaks in the axial vorticity diagram. They are more coherent during the recovery phase, here and here, and when the field is growing, and they become a bit more segmented during the collapse phase. You can do the same kind of analysis on the Kohr-Mantel boundary. Here we're I'm plotting as a latitude versus time diagram the contribution of radial flux to the axial dipole moments. So it's this integral here. The positive parts are contoured separately from the negative parts as a function of latitude and time. Okay? And these red marks indicate the time of the transition. Here the field is dominated by outward flux and has reverse polarity, and here it's changed its sign. The timing of the actual transition is right about here, but you can see in this diagram that there's kind of a precursor signal, where reverse flux appears in both hemispheres prior to the actual reversal event during the onset of the collapse. And we can look at the same effect in the frequency spectra domain. This is the energy spectrum on the core mantle boundaries of function of time from the previous images. So what's plotted here is the energy. It's a function of harmonic degree and time. This is during the collapse with reversal event number one. And this is this other event that I mentioned earlier that has the same general behavior as the reversal event, but produced a collapse but no reversal. What's contoured here is the contribution to the spectrum at each degree, and you should only read the integer values on these maps here. So this is the dipole term, and here is the here's the quadrupole term, octupole term, hexadecapole term, etc. The white curve represents the summation of all the spectral components. This is the total field strength on the core mantle boundary. And for reference here, plotted in yellow is the tilt. And what you can see is that there's a change in the field spectrum on the dynamo boundary during the reversal that's fairly substantial. During this phase here, this is the onset of the dipole collapse. The dipole collapse is marked by a transfer of energy from the dipole field all the way out to spherical harmonic degree 4. And then if you look faintly, you can see that some of this energy apparently moves up towards even higher degrees during the height of the collapse and during the transition period. And then when the dipole restabilizes and begins to regrow in this more kinematic mode, it returns to a spectrum which is dominated by the L equals 1 and L equals 3 terms. So there's a fundamental difference in the character of the boundary spectrum during recovery versus collapse. I guess I'm about out of time, right? Another minute. Okay. So here's what the reversal looks like in snapshots, in 3D snapshots. Here's the growth phase. Here's the dipole collapse phase. Here's the field, the directional transition. And here's the recovery phase. This is the radial field on the outer boundary. These are flux line images from the side and from the polar view. The color contouring of the flux is determined by the same scheme as you would color contour in the equatorial plane. So hot colors represent field lines which are in the positive axial direction of the equatorial plane and blue the opposite. And here's the vorticity. Not much change in the flow. The main effect is the production of this reverse flux inside the dynamo, and then its gradual strengthening, overcoming the opposite side's flux. Here, the dipole field is practically zero, and this is the kinematic recovery phase. Okay, so just to summarize here, from the saturation model, there appears to be a regime, at least, where the dipole moment varies explicitly on the energy source, and as we heard earlier today, that is of the form where the magnetic field strength or dipole moment equivalently varies as the one-third power of the buoyancy flux. This scaling law, of course, has very limited applicability. It seems to depend on the nature of the driving force, among other things. The convective velocity scaling appears to be a bit more robust, and it takes this form in dimensional units. The kind of low-frequency variability you see in the dynamo models involves a magnetic and kinetic energy trade-off with frequency spectra that fall off as epsilon minus 2 or 7/3, and include these very prominent dipole collapse events. As I said earlier, I think understanding the collapse events is the key to understanding the nature of the polarity reversals. And just some phenomenology about the polarity reversals. Of course, they follow the dipole collapses. They appear, in some cases at least, to have reverse flux precursors, so that they might be able to say something about an incipient reversal before it actually happened, and that they involve this forward energy cascade in the magnetic field spectrum. That's it.
We have time for questions. And then you show the dipole push. Have you actually looked at how many sort of
per reversal. What David's referring to is the fact that I'm defining excursion as an actual transient deviation of the dipole from an axial position. What the paleomagneticians define as a excursion is site-specific and involves a deviation of the from dipole symmetry at that site. And that because it's site-specific, you have to analyze these models at specific sites. I haven't done that for this, I should say. It's a short answer. There may be significantly more. There aren't, as a rule, many excursions per reversal in these models. It's not like there's 10 times as many excursions as reversals. But those are excursions as I define them here in terms of the actual dipole. Whether or not there would be more apparent excursions, I actually haven't analyzed.
In some of the reversals you showed after the dipole decay, your recovery was relatively slow. Do you ever get signatures like the sawtooth stuff that Valley et al. Try and identify in the paleomagnetic reversals where the recovery is in fact more rapid than the decay? And would you expect that more just at higher supercriticality?
Yeah, the question is there a real asymmetry in the rate of decay versus the rate of recovery in these reversals? And for the most part, I don't see a real systematic difference in those two rates. Some reversals have that character where the recovery is faster than the decay, but I wouldn't say that they all have that. So I don't know how if there's a systematic difference. There may be some, though, because as I said, they're fundamentally due to different mechanisms. The decay is basically a mixing phenomena. The convection is more variable in time, and it's basically through just vector processes drawing energy off the dipole field. Whereas the recovery phase looks in many cases like a kinematic recovery. And so, you know, that there might be intrinsically different rates in those two processes, but that might be model dependent even.
Do you ever get sustained tilted dipoles where the axis is
sustained,
off axis?
Yeah. You mean a single preferred tilt?
Yeah, where the dipole moment is tilted with respect to the rotation axis and it sustains.
In a fixed position?
Yeah.
I haven't seen an example of a fixed tilted dipole, but there's often a characteristic RMS tilt, of course. I mean, there's a...
Well, I mean, just looking at the L equals 1, M equals 1 component, does that ever dominate?
Yeah, those components are not permanent in these models, so that... there's no preferred longitude, dipole longitude. If I hadn't closed my presentation, I could have showed that. Yeah, there is no preferred dipole longitude, but that's because I have a spatially homogeneous set of boundary conditions. Yeah, it looks like it's random in these, so it doesn't have a very coherent pattern of its own.
Sorry, Peter. So you mentioned reverse flux patch precursors. In some of the lower Ekman simulations by Julien Aubert and by Binode as well, you see these reverse flux patches are associated with plume events. Is there any flow pattern like that in your model that produces these precursors? Is there something dynamical?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of butterfly-like diagram was made up of a bunch of streaks which show kind of a modulation or pulsation. Each of those individual wing elements, if you want to call them that, represent a sort of surge in the overall kinetic energy. So apparently what's happening is the strength of the convection is going up and magnetic field is being pushed out towards the outer boundary. I don't know whether that's due to a single plume or all of the plumes becoming active at the same time, but the effect is to drive flux through the outer boundary and create these patches. And then they get caught in the meridional circulation and carry towards the poles a bit, and that's why they had a little slope to them. So I think it's probably related.
One other question, Peter. Remind me, you did not see precursors in the ones that did not reverse?
The ones that reverse have the same kind of precursors, but really much weaker. Very much weaker. So it seems like there's some relationship between the strength of these precursors and the ultimate depth to which the dipole, extent to which the dipole collapse will continue, which then determines something about the probability of reversal. So the events that have big precursors look like, you know, the way I interpret it is that this instability is stronger in those cases, so you've shoved more flux out of the boundary, and those are the ones that are more likely to end up with a reversal. Yes. Of the ones I've looked at, that's the way it is.